Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. Thanks for listening.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was crying. This is a Spotlight Report.
Sure. Let's
okay.
Go.
Okay.
So this week we are sitting down with Shelby Amott. She got her doctoral degree from the College of Optics, and it was focused on holograms, no pun intended. And she now works at Arizona Optometrology, which is a company that I'm sure does a lot of things, but my understanding is specializes in computer generated holograms. So Shelby, thanks so much for taking the time to talk.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
So how did you get into optics?
So it kind of goes back to high school for me. So when I was in high school and before that, I never really saw myself as a science person at all. I saw myself as more of an artist. And it wasn't until my junior year of high school that I took this astronomy class in my high school that we had a planetarium. And my astronomy teacher just kind of made science feel poetic and grand. And it just really inspired me to have an interest in science. And I became really excited about astronomy from that. And then I went to undergrad and I still wasn't sure whether I was an art or a science person. So I took some art classes and I took some science classes. And so I ended up majoring in physics and minoring in art.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Was that at Arizona or a different university?
No, I went to a small liberal arts college in Indiana.
Okay.
Called DePauw. Really small school, maybe like a few thousand students, even smaller physics department. So by the time I graduated, there were maybe five or six of us in the senior class.
It reminds me of the Arrested Development scene of there's dozens of us.
Right? There's tens of us.
Right? Yeah, it's yep. Even fewer.
Yep.
So you finish that up and grad school is generally a pretty big decision. So what prompted you going all in?
I took an optics class near the end of undergrad that I didn't even know what optics was before that. And we made a hologram. So I thought that was very cool. And that just got me Googling, like, where else can you study optics? And then that's how I found the U of A. And I just didn't know what I wanted to do with my degree. And I think this was during the recession too. I think a lot of people around that time weren't sure if they were even going to get a job right out of college. So I sort of postponed the decision on my career in a way by jumping into grad school. I figured it couldn't hurt. And I was really excited about optics. So that's kind of what prompted me to move to grad school.
Nice. So you came to College of Optics and as I told you, I was reading your dissertation and I clean forgot who your advisor was. Can you remind me of that?
His name is Dr. Ray Kostick. He works in ECE.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very cool. So just from my end, you were first captured by science, particularly with the side of astronomy and how, at least from my perspective, and especially out here in the desert, right, for both of us, it's obvious and grand and big and kind of, causes these deep human questions. How did you end up in holograms?
So the holograms was kind of an accident, actually. So in grad school, in the optics program, you need to pick a research group. And I was actually motivated by renewable energy and passionate about solar energy. So I was really narrowing my focus to whatever group was doing solar research. There were two groups. I looked at a couple of different groups and I really found that Ray's group was a good fit. So, and the holograms were just a super cool bonus in terms of the technology.
Nice. Yeah. And I'll give a very butchered version and then hopefully you can correct me. But my understanding was you looked at two different types of holograms for improving the efficiency performance of photovoltaics. Is that generally accurate? Okay.
Yeah.
And can you kind of tell the audience why and like what you did.
Yeah. So with solar cells, the material that's absorbing the light, it's called a semiconductor, and it has a band gap. And this is like the threshold that light has to have enough energy to cross this threshold. And any light that doesn't have that much energy just passes through. And any light that has too much energy is sort of, it gets captured, but then there's a lot of heat released as it gets down to the band gap. So to make solar cells efficient, it's sometimes better to actually choose different band gaps, some with larger gaps and some with smaller. And then where the hologram comes into play is it takes the solar spectrum and it sends different wavelength ranges to the appropriate band gap. So it either spreads a rainbow across the solar cells, or maybe it acts like a dichroic mirror and it reflects some wavelengths and it passes other wavelengths.
And these variable band gaps, how are they oriented? Are they stacked? Are they oriented kind of laterally on the photovoltaic or on the solar cell? Whatever.
It could be either. Yeah, it could be either. What I was looking at is putting them side by side and then using the hologram to spread light across.
Okay. And for people that are not familiar with holograms, we're using this very casually. Can you explain in a rough sense what it is?
Yeah. I think the best way to think about it is like if you have a CD and it reflects light, but you see the rainbow, it's because there's little structures on that are diffracting the light, which each wavelength, it gets sent at a slightly different angle when it interacts with that structure. So it's kind of like that.
Okay. As an aside, one time I went into my girlfriend's school to give like a little, here's science, here's optics. It's really great. You guys should be excited. And none of them were. They're very bored. I'm not a good teacher. No. And one of the students, I said, you know, like, do you guys have questions? I assume that they hadn't really got anything from what I said. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you have any questions about optics? And one of them goes like, can you explain holograms? You know, I saw Tupac on a hologram on TV and I was like, man, you chose not an easy one for me to explain.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. So what were the two, you investigated two different types of holograms, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do you mind just sharing a little bit about what the differences are between the two and why you might have chosen them?
Yeah. So the two I was looking at, the first one is what's called a volume hologram. And this is where you have a thick film or thick, you know, in a relative sense.
Not this big, like inches, but
microns. It was actually made out of gelatin that's just got this chemical in it. And it's very similar to a photographic process. So what you do is instead of taking a picture of something, you actually record the interference between two beams. And so the beams that we recorded were a beam that represents the sunlight, so light coming straight in, and then a beam that represents a focusing element like a lens. So we literally took a lens and focused the light, and those two beams interacted. And inside of that film, you kind of create that interference pattern. And then when that is developed, then when the sun hits it, it creates the other wavefront. So the sun creates the focusing wavefront. So that was one of the two hologram types. And then the other one was a surface relief hologram. And this was a totally different manufacturing concept where you use a laser. And this is where the computer generated hologram comes in, because in this case, you're not recording an interference pattern, but you're creating one on a computer that does what you think you want it to do. And then a laser kind of scans across and creates that pattern as like a surface relief pattern. But still trying to accomplish the same goal of sending some wavelengths over here and other wavelengths over there.
And so for just the first one, part of its function is to focus as well, right? Mm-hmm. So again, for people that aren't familiar with it, you get this kind of wonderful little, you know, it's thick, but as you said, it's microns. It's very thin film. Mm-hmm. And light comes in. And not only is the light going to split into its wavelengths, like the Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon prism thing, but each of those wavelengths is going to come to a focus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I can
imagine, please correct me, you know, even going back a further step, we can think of these band gaps as like color coded. I have like mm-hmm. the blue band gap. I have the red mm-hmm. band, you know, I know it's more specific than that, but for mm-hmm. people not familiar. And so if I want to focus the light onto my red band gap, why would I focus it? Like, why don't I just have it like the red light goes there, it doesn't have to focus?
That's a really good question. There's two aspects that are important with that. One is that you have a sharp transition between the wavelengths on one side and the wavelengths on the other side. So if you just had like a regular diffraction grating, it would send the red here and it would send the blue there. But there'd still be that overlap unless you let it focus. And then the red's only here and the blue's only there. So there's that aspect. But then also, if you generally focus and concentrate the light onto a smaller solar cell, there's a money savings factor as well, because the semiconductors, at least when I was doing research, they were the most expensive thing. And so if there's anything you do that minimizes the size, but still same large collection area, that's a benefit too.
Sure. Just more cost effective then. That's what I assumed. And I clean did not think about the overlap of colors as well, like that you would have kind of that purple, so to speak.
Right.
Just because it was really wild to read about, can you go through how you made it? Because it you know, I'm reading your dissertation and it's familiar optics, and then chemistry and film. And, you know, like it was such a switch. So do you mind talking about that?
Sure. It's kind of an interesting process. So we start with a glass plate. And then we need to put a uniform layer of this film. So my lab had a dark room, just like a photographic dark room, where we had a spin coater. We would mix our film material and we would deposit it on the glass, spin it really fast. And the speed that you're spinning determines the thickness of the film, which is important. And it affects the efficiency of light that gets diffracted and how narrow the bandwidth is, all sorts of stuff.
Sorry to interrupt you. How thick and how uniform is that thickness in this specific scenario?
Whew, that's a good question. I don't remember how uniform. I know the thickness was somewhere between like 5 and 10 microns. The benefit with the thickness is that the film has an interesting feature, which is that after you've recorded the hologram, it's actually only working over a narrow wavelength range initially. But then when you develop it, you're putting it into these solutions and the film swells, but it swells more at the top than on the bottom. And so it causes what's called like multiplexing. So it kind of stretches the features out in the top.
Right.
And so it's almost like you have a bunch of different diffraction gratings stacked on top of each other, and each one's better for different wavelengths. So there's all sorts of modeling that goes into explaining this effect. But what this tends to do, which is great for solar, is it broadens the wavelengths that this is effective over.
Cool. And Will, I should have said this at the beginning. I mean, I'll obviously link to your dissertation in the notes. And some of the figures too are like really phenomenal. So I'm sure people will like that. And so the second one though, this one, you're in a dark room. I'm simplifying, but you know, I'm picturing you in a dark room kind of cooking this thing up, and you come out and you go like, all right, I have my hologram.
Yeah.
The second one, it's computer generated. So you're designing it and you're saying a laser etches this onto a glass substrate or?
Yeah. So this case, if I'm remembering correctly, we actually used a photopolymer or like a photoresist layer on top of the glass. And then the laser would develop, you know, it would shine over this and it would have varying brightness. So it would have like different exposure levels across it. And then when you develop the photoresist, you basically take it away in those regions when it's developed and create a surface relief in the photoresist.
And so you're loosely, I know this isn't precisely what's happening, but you're kind of engraving these features on your material. What's the size of them for people not familiar?
For this tool, I believe the lateral spacing, it was around a micron, if I'm not mistaken. This was a research tool. So I know that there are laser writers that can get more like half a micron or even smaller. Sure. It all depends on whatever objective you have that's bringing that light to a focus.
Okay.
And then in terms of the depth, it's somewhere within like a wavelength range. So a little bit less than a micron.
And what was the outcome? How'd they work?
This one was really cool for me because I used a MATLAB program to design this thing, hoping it would work, predicting it would work, But still, you know, I could have put a couple of wrong keystrokes into that program and it wouldn't have worked. So it did work. Basically, I don't know if I'm getting too deep into this, but it's a Fourier transform thing, but I sort of modified it so that I was focusing on different wavelengths all at the same time. And my goal was just fit the red wavelengths within this box and fit the blue wavelengths within this box. And I don't care where you put them. That allowed it to have a little bit more freedom. So that was sort of how I designed it. And then I took it into the lab. I have a solar simulator, which is just a bright white light that's collimated. And unfortunately, the distance, this thing is only a centimeter by a centimeter. It only worked over like this distance. Yeah, so I'm just like holding my piece of paper. And when it finally showed the separation of colors, I was really excited about it.
To nice. Know that it worked. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so you wrote the program in MATLAB.
Mm-hmm.
It probably is a little bit too deep for the purpose of this podcast, but you're effectively multiplexing the wavelengths simultaneously in your mm-hmm. Fourier transform analysis.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. That sounds like a headache. But that's awesome. That's super cool. That it
it's a weird way to design stuff. Definitely. It's like, it's not imaging. It's not. Yeah. It's totally different. It's just kind of management of color.
Yeah. Strange. And you, and like you said, you don't care where specifically the red and blue go, for example, it's just mm-hmm. that they're separate and bounded by some box or bounded by some. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So you completed all of that work, I think in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've worked several places. We've actually worked together, which was a lot of fun. But you're now at Arizona Optical Metrology. Mm-hmm. So can you tell listeners kind of what you do there and what it is?
Yeah. So Arizona Optical Metrology is a company based out of Tucson, Arizona. It was started in 2009. By Chenyu Zhao and Dr. Jim Burge. They're both research. Well, Chenyu Zhao was a research professor and Jim Burge was a full professor at the university. And so this was kind of a spin-off company from research that they were doing. Jim was working in the mirror lab, actually making these giant telescope mirrors, and Chenyu was investigating using a hologram to help measure them. And so he developed this company, and for up until about a year and a half ago, it was a two-person company. And then over the last year or so, we've been hiring quite a few people and growing pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's I would say an understatement. It sounds, speaking with you, Jim, and you know, hearing some of the things that Chenyu has said, it sounds like you guys are growing marvelously. So that's fantastic. For people that listen, people that have spoken to me, I don't know if they would listen to the podcast. I don't think that my friends actually would. But they know that when I talked about deflectometry, I would always, so I worked with Jim. That was my first advisor before he departed and Daewoop took over. And he said, okay, we're working on these big mirrors. They're free form optics. They're these funny shapes. It's not just a sphere. It's not just an A-sphere. Maybe it's an off-axis A-sphere, or maybe it's even something crazier. How are we going to measure it for research purposes? We'll do deflectometry. And the way that I would pitch it was, look, you know, we can measure this with an interferometer, but it's a funny shape. So we need a CGH, computer generated mm-hmm. hologram. But why don't we just do deflectometry instead? And nobody ever called me on it, which is great, because I was kind of saying, like, we can do this and it's perfect. Let's do this other thing. So why is it so perfect? Like, why would you use this computer generated hologram to test a funny mirror?
So I think there's, I guess, a couple of advantages with the computer generated hologram. The first one is that it takes advantage of really mature fabrication technology. So the hologram is made with the same types of machines that make computer chips and things that need to be written really, really accurately. You know, within tens of nanometers of position. So we can really trust the tools that make it. And so with the computer generated hologram on an interferometer, you've got interferometric accuracy. So 10th, 20th wave accuracy, maybe even better. And then the other benefit with the CGH is that it's a snapshot full surface measurement. So once everything is set up, you don't have to scan or probe, and it's really high resolution. So, you know, your camera pixels on your interferometer are sort of the limit to that. So those are what I'd say the benefits are.
And so we'll dive into that a little bit more. But before we go on, so for reference, you had said that the second optic that you had made, the hologram, computer generated hologram in your research project, it was maybe a micron between the lines. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
How does that compare to the ones that you guys are making today?
So the ones we make today are the smallest features on them tend to be around 400 nanometers, but like the address unit, I guess, that's writing it is even smaller because we're creating these rectangular structures. So yeah, definitely quite a bit improvement there.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So these computer generated holograms, commonly the application is you're going to toss it in with an interferometer. Mm-hmm. And I guess we should cover that just very briefly. You know, an interferometer in general, it's what's called a null test. So for listeners, not for you. Mm-hmm. Please correct me where I'm wrong, because you know way more about this than I do. But it's a null test. So you have some optic that has some shape, and you need to make the null of that shape. And ideally, you want to make the perfect null, right? It should be a sphere. I'm going to send a perfect sphere. If it's off, I'll see that reflected in the interference pattern. Is that accurate?
Yep.
So, and like you said, I mean, I should know this, but I don't. They've been around for a long time. I don't know when interferometers were first invented. But they're mature. I can buy one, right? Mm-hmm. So why would I need a CGH?
Why would you need a CGH over an interferometer?
No. I mean, let me rephrase that. Why would I need a CGH for my interferometer? I'm going to pay a lot of money for my interferometer.
Yeah.
Why would I go and get a CGH? You know.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the dynamic range issue, I guess you could say. So, you know, if you have an optic that's not spherical or flat, and you put it in an interferometer, that departure is going to make it so that your interferometer can't capture that surface. The fringes that you see are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller until they wash out and you can't see it anymore. So what the CGH does is it's like a custom optic that you pair with your freeform or your A-sphere that allows you to measure it, you know, completely normal to its surface. So it extends the dynamic range of an interferometer.
Right. And I the way that I always thought about it was, we're really good at making, like you said, flat things and spherical things. We can make those really accurate, and we make them, and those are your nulls. Either it's like, here's a precision flat or here's a precision sphere. Mm-hmm. And if your optic is off from that, like you're saying, the interference pattern gets denser fringes, and there's just going to be a limit at some point where it's like, I can't make it out. It all looks like noise to me. Personifying the interferometer. And like what you're saying is, if you have a not even a crazy optic, if you just have an optic that doesn't adhere to those two types, you can make the perfect null. You make the perfect shape, and it's this nice, easy to use wafer, right? This easy to use CGH. Mm-hmm. So what are, you know, before jumping into it more, what are applications of, to ask another naive question, why would I not use a flat or spherical mirror? Why would I ever want a funny mirror, right?
Yeah. This goes into the applications and the technology, and it has to do with wavefront correction. So, and it has to do with saving space. I think that's really what's pushing us away from spheres. So when you're designing an imaging lens, you can use, you know, 5, 6, 7 spherical lenses stacked together, and you have all those degrees of freedom to kind of shape your wavefront and create the imaging properties you want. But you can achieve with one A-sphere what like several spherical optics could achieve. So this way you can reduce the element count in your imaging lenses, or if you have to fold your path, sometimes you require freeform optic to correctly correct the wavefront. And so a lot of like space-based applications or even like heads-up displays and AR systems, they want to save space and become more lightweight. So they tend to fold the path of the beam. Mm-hmm. So I think we're seeing freeforms used to be more of a research concept and not as adapted into manufacturing, but what we're seeing more and more are requests for CGHs for freeform optics. So I think that that technology has definitely matured a lot.
Yeah, and that's good because we would always in the research presentations give this pitch of, you know, no, trust me, freeforms are the future, and it mm-hmm. seems like it's finally here. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is funny how much they range from the telescopes that we would make at the MIR lab or under the college. A freeform could be just, it's an A-sphere, but it's a little bit off axis, right? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't seem too crazy. Still is a shape that you can kind of understand. But like you said, with heads-up displays, those optics are wild, the shape of mm-hmm. them. And eyeglasses, right? They don't manufacture it to the same standard, perhaps, but eyeglasses are freeform. They're not like a sphere, it's crazy stuff. So the application makes sense, the need for them makes sense. And you guys get a customer who says, I need a CGH. How do you know what you need as a customer? Or do you?
So I guess knowing that they need a CGH is more kind of on us and our advertising efforts. The customer has an A-sphere or a free form and they need surface figure measurement better than quarter wave or so, I think they do need a CGH. They may not know all the details of that CGH, and that's where we would come in. So what we usually do is we'll get a drawing from a customer for some component, some surface or mirror. And then on our end, it's kind of up to us to set up the test geometry and figure out the size of the CGH and make sure it's manufacturable and those kind of checks before getting into like a final design process.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to cover there. So just at the top level, how do you know if it's manufacturable or not?
Yeah. Like, so for that,
you know, if I as Joe Schmo walk in off the street and say, I want, you know, a 5-foot by 5-foot CGH, you know, right. Like you would laugh me out of the building. So how do you know?
I think that the more departure your A-sphere or freeform has from a sphere or a flat, the more challenging it becomes. It really comes down to how much does our CGH have to bend the ray to hit the optic? And we can play around with sending in input beams that are close to the shape of the optic. And then the CGH is just responsible for adding a little bit of bending to the path. I think that the shapes that challenge us the most are extreme gull wings, things like that, especially anything that creates, if you were to imagine drawing rays normal to that shape, if they ever cross each other, we've got a problem because a hologram would then have to send light this way and that way. Mm-hmm. Right, so I think those are the most challenging, but there's even ways to get around that in some situations. And there's ways of stitching multiple sections together and things like that. So we always try to come up with some solution, you know, even
something
if it involves
works,
multiple
right.
CGHs or stitching.
And what do you mean by crossing, but are you mm-hmm. saying if the normals cross at the CGH plane?
Yeah.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we can also like move our CGH somewhere where they're no longer crossing each other. And hopefully we'll find a place where that's good.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. And like you're saying, the goal is so this is just a uniform rule. This is nice. I'm learning a lot. There's a uniform rule in optics of never bend the ray too much. One's design because of aberrations, and sounds like the same thing with the CGH.
Yeah.
It's harder.
It's just comes down to the feature size. So you imagine a diffraction grating, the smaller the pitch or the smaller the feature, the larger the diffraction angle, eventually we'll get to a point where it's just hard to create that pattern.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I can imagine it, but for people that aren't familiar with it, and honestly, that frankly includes myself. I only use CGHs as the holy grail, right? So I really don't know enough about them, but I don't get it. Why is it complicated? I'm using a computer. I need to make this shape and my normals can't cross whatever, but mm-hmm. it's a computer, right? I should be able to design whatever I want. And there you go, it's printed. So why is that not the case? From the physical nature of the hologram, I should say.
I think there's just a lot of trade-offs you have to make, and you have to think about a lot of practical things. We have to think about what transmission optics does the customer have? How big is our substrate? We have 3-inch, we have 6-inch. And do we want to put other patterns on that substrate? And that's something that we're starting to include too, are these special alignment patterns and just making sure kind of everything fits together nicely. That's mm-hmm. the part that I think that's more of the art and the finesse of it. But the calculation of the phase that the hologram is making, that's pretty straightforward. It's just a matter of setting up the geometry in a way that makes sense.
Sure. And I guess another to rephrase my question as well, if I naively came into the room and said, I have a collimated laser source, mm-hmm. I want it to, let's call it laser source. Mm-hmm. I want it to pass through the hologram and be deviated, let's say by 5 degrees. Mm-hmm. Is that something doable with a CGH?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's say I want it deviated 180 degrees, not doable.
Interesting.
I guess physically, like not doable, right? But like 179 degrees, crazy. Like it hits and it goes like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's when you start getting into like the deeper analysis of the structure. So you've got a binary grating, which is like a surface relief. That's kind of like a step function. And funky things start to happen when you start coming in at crazy angles with that. Okay. So, and then, like I said, as well, just the fact that to get that angle, you would need features that are so small that it just wouldn't be possible to manufacture it, at least not yet. So it's kind of like those considerations, but.
And that's kind of what I was trying to get at is it's a twofold problem of you get weird physics, weird behavior at weird angles, and the features themselves are super small. But mm-hmm. like you're saying, we might be getting there eventually. We seem to have a knack for making smaller and smaller features on semiconductors. So I'm sure. And this is a pretty similar kind of similar process to how we make semiconductors actually, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense of kind of creating these features at a small scale, but maybe that's where the similarity ends and mm-hmm. to use a laser. But so what are the CGHs often made out of?
So the CGH for us is made, there's two kinds. So there's one kind that's just a chrome pattern on top of a glass substrate that acts like an amplitude grating. And then there's another kind where you actually etch a surface relief into the glass itself, and that's called a phase grating. And you would choose an amplitude grating. It really depends on your test optic and how reflective it is. So if you have a mirror that's reflecting 100% or close to 100%, you would choose a chrome on glass grating, an amplitude grating. And if you're testing a bare glass surface, you would choose a phase grating. The phase grating is more expensive and takes more time to make. So if you can do a chrome grating, that's, you know, faster and cheaper.
The way to go. Okay.
Yeah.
And how long does it normally take? So if I came in and said, I have some preform optic, I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure I need a CGH. How long would that process take?
So that's something we're really pushing to make better. So our typical lead time is 5 weeks, so a little over a month. That's our standard lead time.
Which is really fast.
Yeah.
For listeners to be aware, that's really fast.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's much better than it's been in the past. And we're pushing to, in extreme cases, if you expedite, we're trying to cut that in half, you know, and that's like the absolute, we drop everything fast as we could go. But it's getting better. And hopefully it's more in line with like the prototyping cycles of companies so that they can test things out quickly and make changes.
Are these CGHs reusable? So if I'm a company and I have some, you know, freeform optic, like mm-hmm. you said, right, I'm trying to do rapid prototyping, I test it, I change something, can I just reuse my old CGH, or when do I have to get a new one?
So the CGH is custom made for each prescription. So as soon as you change the design of your optic, you'll need to order a different CGH. The only exception to that is that we also make cylinder CGHs. So similar to a transmission sphere for an interferometer, where you've got convex and concave wavefronts, and you can test all sorts of different radii. Same idea with a cylinder CGH. You can test multiple cylinders with one.
Okay, perfect. I have a lot of questions about CGHs. I'm trying to think of reasonable ones. So you had mentioned you're not only printing the optic that you desire, the null you desire into it. There's other things around it. So what are those other things?
So we're really excited about this. The thing about the CGH is you can print anything on it. And if you can print it all at the same time with one laser writer, they're very accurately registered to each other. And so Jim Birch came up with a lot of creative ideas here in terms of creating alignment patterns that help you align your test optic to your CGH. And especially in the case of something like a freeform, if that optic is misaligned in like decenter and you're trying to compensate with tilt, you're not going to get a perfect compensation. So it becomes really, really important to know your alignment at the same time as your measurement. So some examples of this are just visual alignment aids. So we can have little focusing holograms in the corners that just bring light to a focus right at the edge of your test optic, and you can hold a piece of paper. And then we have some that reflect off of tooling balls and create interference patterns. But the one we're really excited about is called a line focus reference. And these actually are used with corner cubes. A corner cube or a sphere mounted retro reflector, it's the same thing. And the idea is that whatever angle you send light in, it comes out at the same angle. So what we do is we have these little alignment holograms that create focal lines at the corner cube. And if we create one that makes a horizontal line, this is only sensitive to dy. And then we make one that's a vertical line, it's only sensitive to dx. So now you've got like really great dynamic range, because if you're really far out in one, you can still see fringes from the other and kind of work your way into alignment. And you can also understand like each degree of freedom separately, because these are going to be two separate patterns that you're looking at.
Right. So each one, we'll share the website as well for the podcast, but you guys have a great kind of cartoon diagram showing here's a CGH, and then on the edges are these little alignment features. For the line one, is it, so for people who don't have the video, on the top right corner, is it like that's where horizontal lines are made, and on the top left, that's where vertical lines are made? Or is it each one has both lines?
It could be really anything that you want. Okay. Yeah. And so it just kind of depends again on like how much it has to bend the light. So we tend to try to keep it at a reasonable distance, so it's kind of sending the light, you know, to the same position.
So I order a CGH with the alignment lines. I don't think that's the right phrase, but what did you call them?
Line focus reference.
Line focus reference. Mm-hmm. And I have my freeform optic. How do I set this up? Like how do I put my CGH in my system, and then how do I put my optic in, and then we can get to alignment. So,
okay. So the other part of this that we have to make sure of is that your test optic has mounting datums that are kind of placed accurately with respect to these corner cubes. And so the other product.
And what does that mean? Sorry for listeners.
So it's about kind of defining your geometry. So Whenever you have a drawing of your test optic and you say that it needs to be centered, well, you have to understand like with respect to what. So how are we defining that in a physical way so that you can take that measurement? So usually you'll have a back plane and maybe a side. And if clocking is important, maybe you'll have a second side. And those things all help constrain the geometry for alignment and for measurement.
And you can measure them. You can measure them easy too after the fact. A freeform is a freeform. Who knows what part I'm measuring and what it means? But if I have, like you said, you know, a few corners, then I can say like, if I'm setting it down, I know relative to the corners where things are. Okay.
Yeah. And the other part of that is how is it going to be mounted in the final application? So if it's setting against these corners in the back plane in the final application, we just need to set up a mount that's very similar for testing so that we're testing it exactly as it's being held.
Wait a minute. You're saying people actually worry about this? Or they should. That's a joke, but they certainly should. That's a big, Matt Dubin would always gripe about the fact that things would be designed and it's like, how am I supposed to assemble this? So, you guys have great customers. So they say, okay, we know how this is going to get mounted.
Yes.
So you have
hopefully most of them do. Yes.
okay. Perfect. And if they don't, then you can tell them you need to add a few things in here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. So what we're trying to provide now is what's called a metrology platform, which is the whole mount that includes maybe pins that the optic can rest against, and then little holders that can hold the corner cubes, and they're all accurately located. So that's the piece of it that holds everything relative to the test optic.
And sorry to keep asking these questions, but why pins? And what do you mean by pins? If I've never done this, right? And are we talking about hair pins around this, or what are these look like?
Yeah. So pins, I guess. So a pin is like a cylindrical piece of metal. The point, I guess, is that you want one point of contact. You want to have, like, okay, if you know like the outer diameter of that pin really well, then it's not ambiguous exactly, you know, where the optic is when it's resting against the pin. I guess
that's
the idea.
and Jim Burge as well, his background, I think his undergrad was in mechanical engineering.
I think so.
So mounting kinematic mounts, that's his bread and butter. He taught us very quickly in 421, 521. Mm-hmm. I just remember going through a significant amount of mechanical engineering very quickly. And to him, it was like straightforward. And to my mind, I was like, this makes no sense. But
I'm learning a lot. I'm not very good with spatial kind of imagining things spatially. So it's been a good learning experience.
It's interesting how different it feels. It's interesting trying to explain to someone like, man, yeah, I do engineering, but a different, slightly different field of engineering feels really daunting and strange. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to limit my non sequiturs and very basic what is a shape question. But you've mounted this thing, you've mounted it on pins, you know where it is, and you put these SMRs on it, mm-hmm. which, as you described, it's a ball, so you can precisely know where it is, and it reflects light exactly back the direction it came from.
Mm-hmm.
So then what?
So the process of setting up the test, there's two steps. So the first step is aligning the hologram to your interferometer, and then the second step, and that's a one-time thing, and then the second step is aligning your test optic to the CGH. So for the CGH, we'll always include an alignment pattern that is meant to reflect light. So it's a diffraction pattern, but it's working in reflection, and it's meant to reflect that light back into the interferometer when the CGH is aligned correctly. So there's going to usually be a tilt angle of a couple of degrees, and you'll be able to see that as like a return spot, kind of like you're aligning a flat mirror. So that's the first step.
Is there clocking involved, or is it strictly tip tilt usually?
Just tip tilt, because your input beam is either going to be tip tilt and Z, I should say, because your input beam is either going to be a collimated beam or diverging or converging spherical.
Okay, right. So, and if it's collimated, I don't care where it is in Z, right?
Yeah.
It's just, okay. So, but if it is converging, diverging, so you've put in a reference sphere or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I need to know where it is. And is there some other feature on there to tease that out?
So the pattern that we use to align the hologram to the interferometer, if it's used with a transmission sphere, you're going to see power rings in that if you're off in Z. So you're trying to get the power rings out and then get the tip and tilt out.
Okay. So the same, so almost fundamentally a similar process to a flat mirror.
Yeah.
Okay. And the reason I bring that up is this alignment isn't trivial. It's not like, let me kind of nudge it and it's good. Mm-hmm. It's accurate to a degree or less than a degree kind of thing.
Yeah. I think less than a microradian, maybe.
Okay. So very, very precise.
Yeah.
Really and similar in axial position, it's pretty, pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my CGH is aligned. I'm probably feeling very, very proud of myself at this point, but now I have to align my freeform. So how do I do that?
So this is where we want to have lots of different alignment patterns to go from really coarse alignment to really fine alignment, just to make this easier. So for the coarse alignment patterns, we're going to be bringing spots of light to focus in space so that we can have a screen and we can find those spots and just position our mount within like a millimeter or so of where it needs to be in X, Y, and Z. And then once we're there, those corner cube SMR reflectors yeah. should start to show us some fringes. And that's where we can move towards the fine alignment process.
And so you alluded to this, but for people that haven't precisely aligned things, CGH, much less just aligning something precisely on an interferometer, how hard is it? If you don't have those coarse alignment features, what does it look like? If I'm kind of standing there and I'm, you know, mm-hmm. poking and prodding, what am I seeing that's making me think like I should maybe add tilt or, you know, change something in some way?
So you mean in terms of like the interferometric patterns?
Yeah. Like, cause if you haven't done this, you're looking at a computer screen and you're mm-hmm. seeing a lot of fringes, like yeah. a sinusoidal fringe. And it might be almost nonsense, right? It might almost be like, oh my God, I don't see any, you know, pattern or anything here.
Yeah.
Maybe there is something. So yeah. How does it look, I guess?
So for these line focus reference patterns that interface with the SMRs, it's going to look like tilt fringes. And if it's really off in Z, it's also going to look like they have a little bit of power. So they're going to look maybe a little curved. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that you're going to decenter in X and Y to get those tilt fringes out. And then move in Z to straighten them out to make them flat.
Okay.
And this will probably take visual aid to help explain it. But one of the cool things we can do is if we have two line focus references focusing on one SMR, let's say that they're both making a horizontal line. If I'm off in Z, they're both going to give me like a displacement in Y. Oh,
very cool. Right.
And so instead of just trying to get those curved fringes straight, you could have two sets of fringes that are kind of pointing opposite to each other in tilt. And you're trying to kind of get them aligned
with respect to each other. Right. Because they can provide extra reference basically.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. If you haven't done it, it's hard to express how cool that is because it can be such a nightmare trying to align things. And particularly if you don't have any of these reference features, man, good luck, right? So I have everything aligned. Am I good to go? Do I just click run and I get my data?
Yeah. Once you can trust that your fixture is aligned, our goal is that you can just pop your test optic in and out, make sure it's resting against those pins, and then you've got your snapshot measurement. Mm-hmm. So that it really should be that simple.
Cool. And that is a big thing too, just to reiterate, popping the optic in and out is huge because this is a great question for you. So are people using this only for their finished optic? Like, why would I take a measurement of a freeform optic, I guess? Just to know how cool it is? Or, you know, what's my reason?
I think more often than not, people are using it for manufacturing feedback. So you really need to take multiple measurements of the same optic over and over again to create correction maps for your diamond turning machine or for your polishing machine. Some companies, they might be importing their optics and it might just be a quality check to make sure they meet the spec. So I guess it's kind of a mix.
Right. But particularly in those scenarios of manufacturing metrology, that's the bread and butter, right? Of, okay, I made something. I hope it's right. I mean, usually, you know, it's going to be pretty good, but you measure it and you say, ooh, it's off a little bit here. We need to rub it a little bit more here. Mm-hmm. You do that and you pop it back in and say, did it get better or worse? Hopefully it got better. And at the same time, the application of just trying to verify at the end of the day, you know, like, I think this is the right thing. And if you check it and it's off a little bit, that can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. And also depressing, but as the case may be. Well, that's awesome. So what's, I know how I'd use it. I know why I'd use it. Who are the type of people that call you up? It's not going to be me off the street, right? So who are the type of people who are really who really should be interested in this?
I think anyone who is trying to manufacture aspheres and free forms of increasing accuracy, I guess, and to be more specific on applications, I think there's a lot of astronomical applications, telescope applications, aerospace, defense, a lot of now heads-up displays and AR, VR systems. And who knows what else? I mean, we don't always know what the application is, but we can kind of guess as well.
Right. And I can imagine, I mean, in part, I can obviously imagine, you said defense or astronomy. Mm-hmm. I picture NASA or Raytheon or people like that, heads-up display, you know, Meta or whoever, people like that. Mm-hmm. But I also immediately think of a lot of academic or research groups mm-hmm. who, like you said, are working on whatever custom new thing there is.
Yeah.
So what's next? What's like the next big thing that's on the horizon for you guys?
We're moving in a lot of different directions. I think calling ourselves Arizona Optical Metrology kind of begs the question of like, can you expand beyond CGHs even? And what we're moving towards are not just providing you with the hologram by itself and saying good luck, but we want to provide the entire metrology solution, the whole error stack up. We want to provide the mechanics to hold your optic, maybe even provide motorized staging to automate the alignment process. Those are a lot of the things we're looking into to just keep making it easier for people to use these things. And then there's all sorts of research directions. There's a lot you can do with diffractives. We might explore completely other applications. We're also really interested in outreach. So we're working on a demo kit that we're going to give to the university and kind of hopefully populate many universities with these holographic demos to get people to indoctrinate the youth with CGHs.
Right.
So that's something I'm definitely passionate about. But
I want to close with asking about kind of your particular passions and current work. But before I get there, I have to ask, because I saw it on the website. It mentions at the end of the process that I think your guys' software, and if not yours, then you can suss out the information, but it said the word tolerancing. Mm-hmm. How does tolerancing play into this?
So we do perform tolerancing on all of our holograms. We want to give the customer an error budget that they can put into an overall uncertainty so that they can put the error bar on the measurement they get. So it's kind of a standard thing for us to run tolerancing in terms of manufacturing errors like thickness of the substrate, refractive index, and wedge, but also like misalignments. We want to perturb and compensate and understand just how all of these things feed into errors and then build up a big error table for that for the customer.
And why is that important? And I say this because I've worked with a lot of people in a consulting role where they say, like, I don't understand why they can't just make this. Like, what do you mean it has to have, you know, plus or minus some radius of curvature or whatever?
I think that it all feeds into the final application. So if you're making an optic or if you're making a big assembly consisting of all of these optics, you tend to put tolerances on every single aspect of them. But what people don't always consider is not just the tolerance, but the uncertainty of the measurement, which kind of expands the tolerance. And so that's something that will then directly feed into your as-built performance or the yield, how many of them pass the specification. So that's why, I think that's why it's important.
Yeah. That wiggle room on what you actually get, it can be easy to forget that what you designed is not what you'll get in reality. Mm-hmm. It'll be close, but it's not going to be exactly that. And like you said, they stack up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fantastic. And thanks so much for telling me about AOM, but now I want to hear about you. So what are you doing? I mean, I saw you made a TikTok for education. And you're passionate about outreach. Can you tell me more?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I didn't know I was a science person until junior year of high school. And so I definitely want younger and younger kids to at least be exposed to it and understand that science is for everybody. And so that's kind of my big thing, is just whether it's a TikTok video or going into an elementary school. I'm really passionate about that.
Have you gone into elementary schools type of, I assume that's not just a random example. So
yeah,
what works and what doesn't? What did I do wrong when I went into the classroom?
I think just hands-on works. It is like show them and generate some interest and then follow their questions and have them try to answer the question. I think that for them to feel like they can participate in science, I think is really empowering.
Do you have any thoughts on why? I'm going to get a little more abstract here from, you know, the last little bit. I hope you don't mind, but
that's fine.
Why do people not know optics? I'm with you. I grew up in Tucson. I didn't know optics was a thing until freshman year.
That's a good question.
And that was just because they had a cool building, right? So, I mean,
yeah, that's such a good question. I wish I knew the answer to that question. I mean, I think that the idea of being an optical engineer, I think that field has grown a lot since I was younger. And there's a lot of fields like that that didn't exist when the teachers that are teaching the students, or when they were younger. So I think there has to be this interaction between industry and, you know, elementary through high school to just inform them of what's possible, I guess.
Yeah. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. I went on kind of a rant about this the other day to some friends that I think it's getting better, but I had viewed some aspects of the optics community. I think this is the case with any super niche community, as really insular. Mm-hmm. Like people would ask, this is a real pet peeve of mine too. So I really appreciate that you described your dissertation and you described it really beautifully. Like anyone can understand it. And a pet peeve of mine is when you ask someone like, well, what do you do? Well, you wouldn't understand, but it's optics.
The gatekeeping of optics.
Yeah, and it ruins it for so many people because it's like, okay, I guess I'll never understand it. But I do get the sense that that's kind of changing just because it's so prevalent now. My go-to approach was to blatantly lie to kids and tell them we work with lightsabers, and that that got them every time. They were like, "Oh right, I am going to look up optics some more." So
yep.
And all right. So you said you're trying to explore possibly some ways to increase outreach just in your current role, right?
Yeah, I think so. And mentorship, and I don't know, demos and things like that help with it.
Well, if you don't mind, even off the topic of optics, can I ask what type of art did you focus on? What was the medium, or what's your?
So for me, it was painting for the most part. Painting and drawing. And I was really into landscape painting.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Who's the artist that I should look up for this area? How can I inform myself to be kind of more appreciative of art, particularly landscape artwork?
Oh man, that's really good. That's a good question. I'm not really good on art history, but I guess I'm inspired by people like Monet, the Impressionists, going back to optics, they capture light, they capture how light interacts with things really beautifully. So yeah. I think that's sort of what I like doing with art.
Yeah. It was funny. I took Dr. Falco's class, Charles Falco, and he did a lot of work for people who aren't familiar with kind of uniting literal artwork and optics. And I don't know if that had any impact or if it was just getting older, but I went to the Met, I don't know, year, 2 years ago, something in New York. And it was the first time that I was like, whoa, art. Have you guys heard of this thing? You know, like it was mind blowing to me. So,
And I think modern artists have embraced technology a lot more. So I feel like they are starting to incorporate things like holograms and optical filters and shining light through things. I think that is really fun to see is that crossover.
I do think it's a really beautiful way to appreciate that there is fundamentally art. Art and science are fundamentally tied, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, there's this perception of like, ooh, math and physics, like it's so dead and cold, and there is a lot of overlap there. This will be the last oddball question. Then I'll stop. I'll let you off the hook because you've been great. So, this is a good one. It might be a terrible question. So if it is, I apologize. If I personally think about science capturing this idea of a landscape and kind of like a romantic notion of like, whoa, like romantic in the sense of like, wow, like that's almost like a fantastical thing. And generally art, two things pop into my mind. And I want to know which you think is better, 2001 A Space Odyssey or the new Dune movie.
Oh God.
And if you haven't seen them, that's fine. And if you think both of them are terrible, that's also
fine. I'm so sorry to say that I like don't watch movies ever. So I cannot answer because I've never seen any of it. Ugh. I'm so sorry.
No. That's fine. I would not recommend watching 2001. It's one of my favorite movies, but it's also brutally long. And a lot of people have told me they did not like it.
So. I may have seen like the first 5 minutes of it. And like you were saying, I was like, what's going on here? I'm
bored. It's just a slow pan of like a jaguar or something. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
But the reason I bring it up is my answer, whenever I was asked why I went into science, and this is how I got into optics. I talked to Wyant, who at the time was the dean, and he's like, why do you like science? And kind of like a moron, without appreciating who I was speaking to, I was like, well, I like sci-fi, so why wouldn't I like science? And these movies, you know, really, they're the ways that I try to like get people hooked on science. I've given up on books. I find that people don't read books as much. So when I recommend those, they're like, I'm not going for that. So
I love it when people connect other things to science. You know, people that are into music might connect music theory with science. So I think that's really cool.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a, I forget the name of it, but a book talking about, oh man, I should remember this. It's the guy that, I almost want to say it's Helmholtz, but they wrote a book about the quality of music, and it's all speaking about Fourier analysis. It's all about the subtones and kind of like the harmonics that are present, but in lower levels. And that's what defines like the unique sound of a violin, much less that violin, right?
Okay.
Anyway, sorry to totally unrelated, but well, great. I don't have any questions. Is there anything else you want to cover before we call it, or?
No, that's all I got.
Should be good. All right. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.